is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا مِنْهُ إِنَّهُ لَيَئُوسٌ كَفُورٌ وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَاهُ نَعْمَاءَ بَعْدَ لَيَقُولَنَّ ذَهَبَ السَّيِّئَاتُ عَنِّي إِنَّهُ لَفَرِحٌ فَخُورٌ إِلَّا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير صدق الله العلي.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely, he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good. They shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Baghdad is calling for a UN Security Council resolution urging Turkey to withdraw its military forces from all Iraqi territory. Iran's president says the Western side needs to act logically if it wants to see actual results from the JCPOA revival talks. Plus, the United States says Russia's decision to leave the International Space Station in a few years is unfortunate. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half-hour: Iraq has asked the UN Security Council to adopt a resolution requiring Turkey to withdraw its military forces from Iraq's territory. Baghdad's request came days after 9 people were killed in artillery strikes in northern Iraq blamed on Turkey. Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hossein, in an address to the Security Council, called on the UN body to form an independent team to investigate the attack. Members of the Security Council earlier condemned the attack, which took place in Duhok province of Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdistan region. Iraqi authorities believe that the attack on civilians was carried out by Turkish forces. However, Ankara says its forces did not attack civilians. Turkey has launched a new operation against Kurdish militants holed up in northern Iraq since April. Iran's president has blamed the West for creating crisis in the face of talks to revive the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Ebrahim Raisi said the U.S., the U.K., France, and Germany caused the crisis by submitting an anti-Tehran resolution to the IAEA. He said Iran has adopted a rational and logical approach toward the JCPOA revival negotiations. He said the talks can bear fruit if the West pursues the same approach. The IAEA Board of Governors approved the resolution in June. The motion accused Iran of not cooperating with the agency over its past nuclear activities. Iran condemned the resolution and informed the IAEA that it will disconnect some of the agency's cameras installed under the JCPOA. On Monday, Iran said it will keep the cameras turned off until the deal is restored. Political commentator Abbas Aslani explains why Iran has decided to turn off cameras installed by the IAEA.
Iran tried to keep the cameras in place in order to show good faith And it also clinched a deal with the IAEA in order to say that it will record the data by the camera, but once the JCPOA, meaning the 2015 nuclear deal, is restored, it will give the data to the IAEA. But on the other hand, the Director General of the agency, they did not react, you know, constructively to Iranian measures. Iran's argument was that as much as Tehran continues to do measures and moves in good faith, but the IAEA responds in a different way. That's why Iran's Atomic Energy Organization decided to stop those cameras from working. But the solution to this problem is very easy. Once all the parties to the nuclear deal, as well as if the U.S. wants to re-enter the deal, if they return to their commitments under the JCPOA, all the things can be resolved very quickly and easily, and Iran can resume its commitments that were, mentioned in the terms of the deal. But the problem is that the other parties and side, including the IAEA, what they do is that they want Iran to fulfill its commitments just in a one-sided road, but they ignore that they themselves also have some other commitments and obligations to do.
The EU's foreign policy chief says the U.S. maximum pressure campaign against Iran that brought the JCPOA to a standstill has been a failure. Josep Borrell, the EU coordinator for the JCPOA revival talks, made the remarks in an article published by the UK-based Daily Financial Times. Borrell admitted that despite the failure of the so-called maximum pressure campaign, the Iranian people have been deprived of the full benefits of the deal. Borrell said he has offered a text that addresses the removal of sanctions and other steps needed to restore the JCPOA. Hours later, Iran's chief negotiator, Ali Bagheri-Kani, tweeted that Iran has its own ideas to conclude the negotiations, both in substance and form, which will be shared. Iran has once again foiled an Israeli act of sabotage. Earlier this week, the intelligence ministry released a statement saying it arrested members of a terrorist group affiliated with Israeli spy agency Mossad. The terror plot adds fuel to the existing tensions that Tehran says could backfire on Israel in terms of security.
Israel has a history of either attempting to or conducting acts of terrorism in Iran. But more often than not, Tehran successfully discovers and prevents such attacks. On Saturday, Iran's intelligence ministry issued a statement saying that members of a terrorist group affiliated with Mossad were identified and arrested by Iranian security forces before they could take any action to carry out acts of sabotage. The ministry added that terrorists who were in contact with Mossad agents through one of the neighboring countries had sneaked into the country while carrying highly explosive bombs. Later, reports emerged that the espionage planned to blow up a sensitive facility in the central Iranian province of Isfahan. This, however, isn't the first time Israel had planned on carrying out acts of terrorism in the Islamic Republic of Iran. Iran's intelligence ministry forces had also captured individuals linked to Mossad in April. The spies were involved in disseminating classified information and documents. In July, Iran arrested another network of agents while they were carrying a large cache of weapons and ammunition with the intentions of provoking riots and terror inside the country.
Earlier in March, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps foiled yet another Israeli act of terror. The Islamic Revolution Guard Corps said it stopped an imminent Israeli plot to sabotage the Fordow uranium enrichment plant.
Israel has, however, conducted a few terrorist acts against Iran over the past years, namely the murder of top Iranian scientists and army generals and acts of sabotage on nuclear sites. Yet, interestingly enough, the regime continues such atrocities without being held accountable by the international community, and more specifically the U.S., who has supported Israel through its veto power in the United Nations Security Council.
The impunity with which Israel carries out such attacks, or in this case, makes such plans, is fully enabled by the United States of America, which at this point, I believe, should be deemed responsible for the crimes and the destabilization that the apartheid state of Israel engages in. The primary way that the United States enables the crimes and the destabilization of Zionism and the colonialist apartheid state of Israel is through its veto in the United Nations. Since 1972, the United States has vetoed 53 resolutions attempting to hold Israel to account by way of international law.
Israel also has a track record of assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists. That's in addition to acts of sabotage in a section of Iran's nuclear facility in the city of Karaj. These are actions that threaten the entire region, yet the regime accuses Iran of destabilizing the regime, or the region.
Israel has been involved in a string of sabotage attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities in recent years and has killed many top nuclear scientists and military officials in cowardly strikes. More recently, on May 22nd, Colonel Hassan Sayyad Khodai was assassinated by two motorcyclists who shot him five times before fleeing the scene. He was dismounting his car to enter his home in an eastern neighborhood of the Iranian capital when three bullets hit him in the head and two bullets in the hand. While Israel has yet to officially comment on the incident or take blame, all reports and facts indicated that it has so far been behind the terrorist activities in Iran. Regarding the Khodai case, American outlet The New York Times cited an intelligence official as saying that Israel has informed American officials that it was behind the assassination. Despite all this, the regime continues its petty attempts of trying to accuse Iran of destabilizing the region.
Israel attacks its neighbors on almost a daily basis, for example, bombing Syria, whereas Iran has not attacked a neighboring country in over 300 years, or almost 300 years. Furthermore, the very well-known international human rights organizations, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, as well as B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights organization, have deemed Israel to be an apartheid state, which inherently, as such, destabilizes the region. So there's nothing new here in terms of the Israeli and American narrative, their propaganda regarding Iran. What I do see as new and heartening is the fact that the effectiveness of this narrative is weakening very rapidly.
Israeli atrocities have also garnered fierce response from Iranian officials. The chief commander of the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps has warned that Iran will take a harsh revenge on those who assassinated a member of the force in Tehran.
The commander of the Iranian Army's ground force has warned that Tehran will raise Tel Aviv and Haifa if Israel makes any attempts against Tehran. Brigadier General Qumars Haydari also stated that Israeli occupied territories will be liberated in less than 25 years.
Russia says it's planning to leave the International Space Agency after 2024 as tensions between Moscow and the West escalates over the conflict in Ukraine. The announcement was made by the new head of Russia's space agency, Yuri Borisov. He said Moscow intends to build its own orbiting outpost. He, however, noted that Russia will fulfill all its commitments to its partners in the International Space Station until 2024. The United States has reacted to the plan, calling it an unfortunate development.
It's an unfortunate development given the critical scientific work performed at the ISS, the valuable professional collaboration our space agencies have had over the years, and especially in light of our renewed agreement on spaceflight cooperation.
Price also referred to the sour ties with Moscow, saying although the relations are fundamentally changed, the U.S. still likes to preserve relations in some aspects, including scientific pursuits. The information of the long-mooted move comes as tensions between the Kremlin and the West have mounted over the Ukrainian conflict. The U.S. and its Western allies have imposed several rounds of devastating sanctions against Russia, including its space sector. Well, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says Russia is using gas prices to terrorize Europeans and deserves to face tougher sanctions.
Among other things, the engineered increase in gas prices to above $2,000 for 1,000 cubic meters on European markets. This is enough of an experience to broaden sanctions against Russia, as it is clear to everyone that this is intended Russian price terror against Europeans. Using Gazprom, Moscow is doing all it can to make this coming winter as harsh as possible for the European countries. Terror must be answered. Impose sanctions.
Russian energy giant Gazprom is planning to reduce gas supplies to Germany to a fifth of its capacity, citing equipment troubles. But European officials believe Moscow is in fact seeking to inflict more pain on Europe for supporting Ukraine. On Tuesday, the EU member states agreed to decrease natural gas consumption by 15% in a bid to reduce dependence on Russian energy ahead of the cold winter months. In the race to replace Boris Johnson as leader of Britain's Conservative Party and Prime Minister heated up when the two candidates, former Finance Minister Rishi Sunak and Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, made their pitches on live television. In a sometimes ill-tempered debate, both candidates were quick to attack each other's record and credibility. Amina Taylor watched the political drama unfold and reports from the British capital.
You dismissed us and it has cost taxpayers 70.
After the warm-up bouts of debates featuring multiple leadership candidates, it was time for the final two to square off in a live televised debate. The head-to-head was the first opportunity viewers, including the estimated 170,000 members of the Conservative Party eligible to vote in the leadership race, could see Liz Truss, Foreign Secretary, face off against former Chancellor Rishi Sunak. Each wasted little time attacking each other's records and credentials and clashed heavily on their individual taxation plans to bring the country out of its worst cost of living crisis in generations.
We are an outlier. Everybody understands that COVID is a 1-in-100-year event, and trying to pay it back straight away, so quickly, that we actually damage our economy, that we end up causing a recession, that we end up in people being out of work, and that hard-working taxpayers who do the right thing have seen their taxes rise, despite the fact that we promised in our manifesto
You just mentioned three countries. Do you know what mortgage rates are in the US at the moment? Do you want to use them as an example? Their mortgage rates are almost 50% higher than mortgage rates in this country because they're borrowing so much.
Canada actually has project fear.
The candidates vying for the country's top job have not shied away from going after each other's political juggler. Some of the exchanges have been brutal, with the former chancellor accused of talking down to his political rival, while Liz Truss has honed in on Rishi Sunak's immense wealth. Now, Tory grandees are fearful that whoever wins this vote, it's actually the Tory party with all of this mudslinging that will be the eventual loser. Former Mayor of London Ken Livingstone has been keenly observing the leadership race.
If I think back, 50 years ago, someone running for Prime Minister had been a cabinet minister for decades, had had massive efforts running things, and this is, they've hardly done anything, I think this could be the worst government of my lifetime, perhaps even worse than Boris Johnson's. I think Rishi Sunak comes over as much more competent. And, his rival's tax policy could tip us into a recession. So I don't know. I want Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, to be Prime Minister. Out of those two, I'm not the slightest doubt. We need to have Rishi Sunak. He will be much more competent than his rival. She's just completely unimpressive.
Polls have Rishi Sunak trailing Liz Truss amongst rank-and-file Tory members, and with ballot papers being sent out in early August, both candidates want to build momentum. The results of the leadership ballot will be revealed on September the 5th, still years ahead of a general election that will see the nation have the final say. Amina Taylor, London.
A powerful earthquake has rattled northern Philippines, causing damage to many buildings. At least one person is confirmed dead and multiple injuries have been reported. The 7.1 magnitude quake sent panicked residents rushing into the streets. It has damaged buildings, including heritage sites in Abra and nearby provinces, and caused landslides in some areas. The tremor was even felt many kilometers away in the capital, Manila, where several buildings were evacuated. Earthquakes are common in the Philippines, but this one was the strongest to hit in years. Seismologists say big aftershocks are expected. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
In the limelight.
It is still not too late to end the war, provided NATO ceases its meddling and the warmongering US abstains from sending massive military hardware which do not bring peace, says Kahan International Staff Writer in an article published under the heading US Fanning Flames of Ukraine War. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. It is now 5 months since NATO pushed Ukraine into an unwanted war, when policies in the Zionist-influenced corridors of power in Kiev, where the interests of the Ukrainian people no longer matter, could have averted military confrontation with Russia. Even when Moscow had no other choice but to send its troops across the common border of the two Slavic countries in order to prevent the US and the European Union from militarizing Ukraine, the war could have been stopped through diplomacy. It didn't happen. Wisdom was sidelined because of the devilish intentions of the US to fan the flames of war through supplies of billions of dollars of sophisticated weapons that only seems to have made Russia more determined to counter what it deems as growing threats from the West to its national security. The result has been catastrophic, with more than 9.5 million Ukrainians fleeing the country and a third of the 42 million population displaced, in addition to global food shortages, since fertile and agriculturally rich Ukraine is among the breadbaskets of Europe and the world. It is still not too late to end the war, provided NATO ceases its meddling and the warmongering U.S. abstains from sending massive military hardware, which do not bring peace, but invite more attacks from Russia to test its own armaments against American weapons. The recent attack on the port of Odessa that destroyed military infrastructure and sank a Ukrainian warship is an example in this regard. If this attack obstructs grain supplies to other countries, the culprit is Washington, which seems intent upon derailing any agreement between Kiev and Moscow for grain supplies, worked out through mediation of other countries, Turkey in this particular regard. The U.S. is boasting that it has so far sent $8 billion of weaponry to Ukraine, and according to its Secretary of War, Lloyd Austin, an Afro-American with a slavish mentality to obediently serve white racist interests, Washington is to send more high-mobility artillery rocket systems to Ukraine. It is obvious that Ukraine is being used by the West as a battleground for field tests of military hardware, which means the war is not likely to end anytime soon. Still, however, efforts should be made by the UN and peace-loving world countries to stop the unnecessary fighting. At the same time, NATO should stop its bid to ensnare more hitherto neutral European countries into its US-controlled warmongering network, as is the case of Finland and Sweden. This will only make Russia to take preemptive action, which will be detrimental to peace, even though Sweden is ruled by a clique that provides asylum to some of the most dangerous terrorist outfits and has a scant respect for the welfare of the Swedish people. To sum up, the sooner the war ends, the better for not just the people of Ukraine and Europe, but also for the whole world, which can ill afford the soaring cost of grains and foodstuff.
IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Sports in Palestine faces a lot of obstacles that disturb the true essence of what sport is about. Under Israeli occupation for more than half a century, the industry of sport suffers greatly, just as the Palestinians themselves suffer daily.
We participated in several championships, including the Batna International Championship in Algeria. We also participated in the Arabic Championship and took fifth place. However, Palestine was deprived from participating in many external championships due to the Israeli siege that has been imposed for the past decade. In those 10 years, time goes by, along with the age of players, which means the end of their sporting career.
The Israeli occupation does not like to see Palestinian sports that represent the Palestinians as a civilian nation to the world with the ability to compete with other teams. The Palestinian athletes do not have immunity at all. Palestinian sports in general is not immune, whether in times of war or without war. You may find the Israeli warplanes shelling a sports club or stadium, arresting a player, or preventing a team from participating abroad.
And now, the national anthem of Palestine.
Sports for Palestinians could perhaps play a role in international forums. But the Israeli occupation does not want any positive attention to shine on the occupied territory, and so it oppresses sports development as a strategy to keep the international community away from the occupation's repressive activities.
For your information, in some championships, Israel imposed on the host nation not to raise any country's flag so that Palestine's flag would not be raised. However, in the last championship held in Australia, Israel was not able to dictate its preferences. So Palestine's flag was raised and the Palestinian anthem was played when the Palestinian team marched out on the grounds. This is considered an achievement for us.
Having Palestine's flag raised in the Asian Championships for the first time was a huge achievement. However, raising our flag in Australia is our biggest achievement, especially as we know Australia voted against Palestine 2 weeks before at the UN Assembly. Our nation has the right to have a state and live in peace. We deserve to live. Today we are among 16 Asian countries. Although our country is under siege and the most basic necessities do not exist, our national team is here today, among the teams of great countries like Japan, Iran, Australia, Korea, and others. When hearing the national anthem here in this stadium with the players and technical team, in which I'm a member, with the rest of the Arab, Palestinian, and Asian audience, which supported our team to the finals, it gives you an indescribable feeling. This feeling comes because you're one of the soldiers who participated in raising the flag of your country in the international arena.
The Palestinian team qualified to the finals in the Asian Cup for the first time in history. The Asian Cup started in the 1960s. The Israeli occupation used to participate among other countries under the name of the State of Israel, as if Palestine did not exist. In 1970, a group of noble and honest Arabs expelled Israel from the Asian Football Confederation and replaced them with Palestine as a member. We regained our right to membership of the International Football Federation, in which we can participate in the World Cup. The occupation knows that sports creates a good image toward the Palestinian people, so it wants to sabotage it, destroy it, and hide it from the world. It wants to present the Palestinians to the world as terrorists.
For every athlete in Palestine, there is a sad tale of suppressed opportunity under the Israeli occupation, which deliberately puts obstacles before the Palestinian sporting industry to keep it behind closed doors.
One of the circumstances that helped me play football was living near Rafah Services Club and the UNRWA Club. I was able to get into the national junior team, the national youth team, then the Olympic team, and finally the national team. I received the best junior player title in the Palestinian League for the year 2005 to 2006. On July 22, 2009, I was supposed to travel to the West Bank to join Balata Youth Center Club as a professional player at the boot camp of the national team in Al Farah. However, some other players and I were stopped, and I was arrested. I was the only one among them to be arrested, and without reason.
I was assigned to form the Palestinian Federation for Self-Defense Games, sponsored by the Paralympics Committee. This committee is specialized in training special needs athletes in order that they may participate in international championships and the Olympics. We received an invitation from the MRT Ahli Club to participate in the Dubai International Championship of 2016. We participated with a team of six players, one able female, an able male, and four visually impaired athletes. Our team competed strongly in this championship, and for the first time in Arab and Palestinian team, won third position and received a bronze medal. It feels great to raise the Palestinian flag and play the Palestine national anthem at such a championship. Upon our team's return back home, I was arrested by the Israeli police and detained for 5 hours, and the blind players were also held. My team insisted on not leaving without me. How could they leave when they have no one to guide them back home?
It's no coincidence that the arrest of Palestinian athletes has pushed a number of prisoners from the sports sector to more than 70. This number refers to the expansion of deliberate targeting of promising sports champions by the occupation.
I was detained without charge for no other reason than for being a Palestinian athlete representing my country. I spent 3 years in the Israeli prisons. During my sentence period, I was interrogated from time to time and manipulated to try to make me confess to anything. But in the end, they had to let me go. It shows to what extent the Israeli intelligence had nothing on me. They wanted to prove that they did not just arrest a Palestinian athlete, but a terrorist from their view. They could not prove anything, so they released me after 3 years. I was released, but with many health problems, because I had gone on a hunger strike for 96 days. These problems prevented me from continuing my football career. I do not wish for any athlete to experience the same situation I faced.
Upon our arrival to the Erez Beit Hanun checkpoint, we were supposed to have a press conference with a number of international journals and agencies. But to our surprise, I was arrested and the blind boys were held and pushed outside. I was held for 26 days in the interrogation cells at Ashkelon prison. They accused me of training terrorists. I responded, "If you say that these blind boys are terrorists, I wonder how you can call them terrorists." It was bizarre that the interrogator was watching some reports on YouTube about the team, and he knew that I was training these blind boys. They presented me with a number of trials, 5 trials consecutively. Each trial extended my arrest period. I was released after the last trial, innocent of all charges. I believe that the whole thing was for the purpose of disruption and killing of our happiness, so that the people in Gaza would not feel the joy of our success.
The case of Hassan al-Rai is not the first one. We have more than 70 to 80 cases like his. There is the case of Sami Ad-Daur, who was arrested simply for being a national team player, along with Fadi al-Sharif. Ayman al-Nafadi received a medical transfer to have a crucial ligament operation. After his operation, he returned back to Gaza and was immediately arrested with his fresh injury. Beit Hanun Eretz checkpoint has become a daily arrest and interrogation point. Its purpose is to insult people. How could a country that presents itself as being a democratic state grant an entrance visa to someone and then arrest them?
Israeli violations were not limited to false arrests. They adhered to discriminatory policies of not issuing travel permits for players to participate in both domestic and international championships.
Athletics games are competitive. It requires capabilities. To become international, you need tremendous capabilities. It requires the potentials of countries, not individuals. Because of the siege on our country and the closure of the Rafah border crossing for the past 2 years now, Palestinian runner Inas was not able to travel to participate in a championship in the UAE. She was not given a pass to travel across Eretz Point. Furthermore, she was supposed to participate in the Beit Lehem 10-kilometer marathon, but she did not get a checkpoint pass for that either.
We exercised hard to have our names included in the Bethlehem Championship, but because of not receiving a checkpoint pass, I was deprived from participating. I trained intensely for the 10-kilometer race for 2 months prior to the race, even though I knew I had no permission to pass. We practiced hard, and I think maybe we could have won first place in that competition.
As a trainer for the national team, I suffered a lot moving between the governorates to reach Ramallah to be with the Palestine national team. It was hard for the players I chose from the clubs in Gaza to reach the northern governorates, which affected the competitive level of the national team. It is hugely suffering for the athletes inside Palestine.
We could not get the majority of our players to the northern governorates because of the delay in getting checkpoint passes. On one hand, because these games have specific dates, and on the other hand, the permissions to pass were either denied or given after the expiration of the specific date of the games, so Gazan athletes did not participate in these games.
Palestine participated in the 2010 World Cup playoffs. According to the draw, we were supposed to face the team of Malaysia. As we do not have a home ground, we used to play our games outside Palestine. We were matched up with Malaysia in an away game. We were supposed to meet the team in Malaysia, but 3 days before the match, the Israeli occupation prevented the Palestinian team from leaving. This injustice was not confined to the Israeli occupation. FIFA too was unjust towards us when it issued a statement in which the Palestinian team was condemned for not participating.
Practically every country in the world has a unified football league, with the exception of Palestine, which is forcibly deprived of that right. So the Palestinian Football Union seeks to at least unite the West Bank and Gaza Strip leagues to try to address Israeli measures that impose separation between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
The occupation is what divides the Palestinian territories into smaller parts. I'm referring to the 1948 Palestinian territories. There are the northern governorates of the West Bank and the southern governorates of the Gaza Strip. We try as much as possible to unite these communities by holding local competitions with the Palestinian clubs in the governorates of our land.
We have a diaspora league, the West Bank League, and the Gaza League. The teams in Gaza are not permitted to meet the teams of the West Bank, nor the diaspora. I mean, Barcelona and Real Madrid can move throughout Spain, but in Gaza, its teams play only each other, and the teams within the West Bank play each other. So there is one champion in Gaza and one champion in the West Bank. We've been appealing to the world to pressure the occupation to allow our teams access across checkpoints. This appeal is 20 years old now. We've had 20 years of league championships in Gaza, which have all been kept separate from the West Bank championships.
When the Palestinian National Authority took over, there were many attempts to have one unified league between the West Bank and Gaza. However, the obstacle of not having to pass the district prevented players from coming together. This also resulted in poor communications between the athletes and teams from each area. So we had to come up with the compromise of having two leagues. One league includes the clubs of Gaza, the other includes the clubs of the West Bank. I hope one day the winners of the two districts can play each other.
For a quarter of a century, we've appealed, and I myself appealed to football officials associated with FIFA, which is to have one unified Palestinian league. We want a league similar to that of the USA, Russia, Britain, Spain, France, Germany, and all countries around the world. We want to establish a unified league that unites the West Bank and Gaza, but Israel stands against this.
Setting a precedent, the Palestinian Football Union, in 2015, held a match between trophy champions of the West Bank and Gaza, despite all that was done by the occupation to prevent any such meeting.
In 2015, the winners of the Cup of Gaza for the first time in 15 years met up with the winners of the West Bank Cup. They met despite the will of the occupation because of the intervention of FIFA. The away game was held in Gaza while the home game was held in the West Bank, and then we pronounced the outright winner.
The union decided to hold a match between the champions of the northern governorates and southern governorates so as to decide a unified champion that would represent Palestine in the Asian Games. The match was between the Shujaiya Union Club, representing Gaza governorates, and Al Khalil Ahli Club, representing the West Bank. The Al Khalil Ahli Club won the championship.
We were excited, but Israel obstructed the event by arresting a number of players, and the Shabak Israeli Security Agency interrogated them for several hours. In addition to this, many players were refused a checkpoint pass. If it was not for the interference of FIFA and other countries, this sporting event would have not been held.
The escalation of violations by the occupying forces against Palestinian sports and athletes did not stop at international norms. Its momentum increased in the wars waged by the occupation on Gaza, the most violent of which occurred in the summer of 2014.
Palestine Stadium was shelled with a dozen bombs, each weighing about a ton. The stadium was completely destroyed. Not only the stands, but the whole field was unplayable. The Rafah Municipal Stadium was also shelled in 2008. This city has champion teams.
but we've been unable to rebuild the stadium until now. Till now, I find it difficult as an athlete, a Palestinian, or even a follower of sports and current affairs to understand why the occupation would bombard playgrounds and sports clubs. We don't know the reason except to think that the occupation does not want to see any young Palestinian, especially athletes, to achieve greatness in sport or for them to play other Arab teams or internationally.
Rafah Stadium was one of the targets of Israel's military complex. We don't know why. It is just a stadium like any other around the world. Palestinian youth play in this stadium. It was, however, shelled with more than just one bomb by an F-16 warplane. The building and the grounds were completely destroyed. Now it is a playground without any stands. Of course, the field is not suitable to play on, but it is the only one that exists. Fragments of steel and rock can be still seen there. Many players stayed away from the stadium because of the bombardment.
Clubs were bombed, centers were bombed. More than 30 sports locations were bombed during the aggression on Gaza. There are no more than 5 stadiums, so the agenda of the General Federation of Football was affected dramatically. The capacity of other stadiums is limited, so by shelling these stadiums, from the Israeli perspective, it totally disrupts Palestinian sports.
The recent war on Gaza by the occupation's military exceeded every human standard and killed more than 27 Palestinian athletes. They joined the long list of victims who were athletes and martyred.
In the past 20 years, 400 or so Palestinian athletes have been martyred. These athletes are from all kinds of sporting backgrounds, football, volleyball, handball, and individual sports like martial arts. All of these sports lost memorable players. More than 400 Palestinian martyrs sacrificed their lives for the cause of Palestine. The Palestinian athlete is a Palestinian citizen before he or she is an athlete.
Israel deliberately targeted the sports sector as it did other sectors, such as health, social, and economics. We in the sports sector have 400 martyrs. At the top is Captain Ahad Zakout, who is one of our trainers. Many young players also were assassinated in the southern governorates. We as sports people are supposed to have immunity under international law to travel and participate, but Israel flouts these laws and international regulations.
On the morning of July 30, 2014, one Israeli war jet targeted a residential apartment with a rocket. The apartment was owned by the late athlete Ahed Zakout in the Al Nasser neighborhood in Gaza City, bringing an end to the life of an athlete who continues to inspire many even after his death.
I woke up to the voice of my mother screaming my name and my father's name, Khaled and Ahad. I went out and answered, "Here I am." She asked me where my father was. I say, "I don't know. I will look for him." She ran out of the house screaming for someone to help. The living room was on fire. A missile had hit the house, smashing walls and room and setting the living room on fire. My uncle was the first to enter our house.
I turned around and came into the house. The bedroom door was broken, blocking the entrance. I kicked it with my leg and was surprised to see Ahed lying under the separating wall between the bedroom and the living room. He was still breathing. His son then entered and started screaming.
We told him to bear witness that there is no God, but Allah and Muhammad is his messenger. In his last moments, he was opening his mouth and closing it. Then the ambulance came and took him to the hospital, but he was later taken to the cemetery.
Captain Ahed Zaqt was the star player of the Palestinian National Football League. He was the star of Gaza Sports Club and played in many clubs inside Palestine. Then he became a trainer after retiring as a football player. He focused on the youth. Captain Ahed Zaqt wanted Palestine to have a promising future. He focused on having a national Palestinian team that would qualify for the finals of the World Cup in 10 years' time. But it seems this dream did not appeal to Israel. The Israeli occupation focuses on how to hit us at the core.
Despite all the crimes committed by the occupation against Palestinian sports and athletes, they would not be able to achieve their aims to undermine the resolve of the aspiring athletes who hope to represent Palestine at international tournaments and to hold high the Palestinian flag in states that have ignored and still ignore Palestinian rights.
In the limelight. In the fight against inflation, the European Central Bank, ECB, the Bank of England and the US Federal Reserve risk either doing too much too soon or too little too late. We have prepared for you an article written by Larry Elliott. The piece is titled Interest Rates, the Three Central Banks Facing One Tricky Balancing Act. Whatever it takes. With those three words, the then head of the European Central Bank, ECB, quashed doubts in July of 2012 about whether the euro had a future. Mario Draghi's message to the financial markets was that they should not doubt his commitment to defend the single currency. The warning worked. 10 years later, the European Central Bank, the ECB, is again in the spotlight. But so are two other major central banks, the US Federal Reserve and the Bank of England. All three are facing the same problem, what to do about annual inflation rates that are nudging 10%. A crucial month kicks off on Thursday, 21st of July, when the European Central Bank will raise interest rates for the first time in 11 years. With neat symmetry, Mario Draghi is once again playing a pivotal role, this time by threatening to quit as Italy's Prime Minister. The prospect of the European Central Bank toughening its stance had already alarmed the markets even before a political crisis in the Eurozone's third biggest economy loomed. Investors demanded a higher premium for financing Italy's huge national debt. So, in an echo of events in 2012, the yield or interest rate on Italian bonds has risen. The gap or spread, when comparing with German bond yields, can be expected to widen further should Mario Draghi resign. This creates a dilemma for the European Central Bank. On the one hand, it is committed to tackling inflation, but on the other, it wants to minimize the impact on Italy. IPEC Oscar Descaia of Swiss Bank said, "No matter if Italy goes into turmoil or not, the European Central Bank will have to hike interest rates in the coming days and say that they will do more if needed in the coming meetings." Christine Lagarde, Mario Draghi's successor as European Central Bank president, said her team would come up with a new instrument to shield Italy from any adverse impact of higher interest rates, and the financial markets expect her to deliver in the coming days. Neil Shearing, the chief economist at Capital Economics, said 10 years after Mario Draghi's pledge to do whatever it takes, Christine Lagarde risks repeating history. She must avoid drifting into another crisis that would ultimately require her to make a similar pledge to her predecessor. The weakness of the euro against the US dollar is an added complication, and one reason for the single currency falling below parity for the first time in 2 decades, earlier this month, is that the US interest rates are already at 1.5% to 1.75%, while the European Central Bank's main interest rate is zero. So after recent decision in Frankfurt, attention will shift to Washington, D.C. Whereas the decision for the European Central Bank boils down to whether interest rates should rise by a quarter of a percentage point or half a percentage point, the U.S. Federal Reserve is mulling whether to tighten by 0.75 percentage point or even a full percentage point. Up until the release of the latest U.S. cost of living data, the assumption on Wall Street was that the U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell and his colleagues would repeat June's 0.75 percentage point increase. However, recent news that inflation had jumped to a 40-year high of 9.1% unsettled investors by prompting fears of a tougher response. Krishna Guha of Evercore, the investment bank advisory firm, said the signs were that the U.S. Federal Reserve would opt for the smaller 0.75 percentage point increase. He said, "This is still a big move and we expect the U.S. Federal Reserve will be resolutely hawkish in terms of the rate path, the future course of borrowing costs, but sticking to a steadier sequence of hikes reduces the risk that the Fed overshoots badly. That is, raises interest rates much more than ultimately turns out to be required to tame inflation. The same tricky balancing act, preventing inflation from becoming embedded while at the same time avoiding sending the economy into recession, is causing headaches at the Bank of England, which will be the last of the three